Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.
Hey everybody, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out to Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. This is actually take two. You guys missed the first take completely because it was a disaster. I actually recorded like 15 minutes in and I was like, I got to stop. I don't know. I think I'm still a little flustered from yesterday after Charlie Kirk's execution on the heels of the young lady who was executed in the train or whatever the Charlotte transit system is down there in North Carolina. Just been a really interesting time, and started recording today and I just was like, you know what? Maybe today's not the day, but we're going to try again. Today's warm-up song is Puff the Magic Dragon, brought to you by Peter, Paul, and Mary, a special song about a young boy and his magical dragon. I want to send a thank you to all the Buy Me a Coffee supporters and members. A special thank you to our newest worker tier member, Michael. I greatly appreciate the support from everybody, and it is what allows me to keep doing this every day. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Today we're going to dive in and we're going to talk about spring pollens versus fall pollens, why they're different, how bees use them, they're ramping up in the spring, and long-term survival for the winter. We're going to go through all of that. At the end, since it is September 11th, at the very end today, for anyone who wants to stick around, so if you're like, I don't care, I have life to live and things to do, I completely understand. But in the interest of 9/11, I will share my 9/11 story with you at the very end. Oh, and for those of you wondering, the cat is still kicking here. I thought literally it was like a week ago Thursday, I was like, it's over, he's done, but he's bouncing back. The new rice, chicken, and egg meal we've mixed up for him, he's been all over it. And, no more, blowing out the backside all over the house and various places. He is now 100% back in the litter box. So fingers crossed there. Thank you for the warm wishes from everyone on that one. Okay, so I want to talk to you about something that a lot of people don't really know about. And it's one of those things that if you don't do research or whatever, it'll never really, it's not something like as a new beekeeper, if you don't know this, it's going to be a problem. As a new beekeeper, you don't even really have to focus on this. If you just let the bees do what they do in nature, you support them with good Varroa treatments and IPM management, that's integrated pest management. If you're supporting them with a good management strategy, you're taking care of them, feeding as needed. This is something that kind of won't really come up, but it's a really cool thing to know and to understand. I think you'll see with this particular podcast, one of the things that I've done for a really long time is, and I think maybe it actually turns some people off, is I've always tried to keep it at a basic level. I've always tried to just stay laser focused on the new beekeeper. And in a way, once you've been listening for like a couple of years, you're like, all right, it's kind of like a lot of new stuff still. Like I want to dive deeper. I want to peel back, the layers of the onion a little bit. That's kind of what this is. Just a little touch, just a little skimming the surface of going a little bit deeper. I think for some people, it's really, really beneficial to kind of understand the why and the intricacies of things and how it's all tied together. It's an amazingly, just incredible system for pollen and how it works and why it's different at different times of year and why it's right on time, just as nature or God or Allah or Buddha or whatever you believe in intended. It's a cool thing. So I want to go into that just to kind of give you a little more of that insight. And like I had mentioned a while back, I'm trying to do a bit more of this kind of dabbling into what I would say takes us beyond sort of that introductory apprentice level and maybe more into the journeyman type of level of discussion. And I'm really hoping that it's pouring down rain. I'm hoping that does not come through here for all of you. If it does, then my apologies. Okay, I'm going to speak to you about two areas here at the same time, like I kind of typically do just to show some of the differences. But at my home, it is about 95% tree pollen. So, I'm talking like your maple, elm, alder, poplar, oak, birch, sycamore. These are all trees that are kind of around me. This is the predominant food source for my spring bees. These pollens are very diverse. They have a nice balance of all the amino acids that the bees need. And this is critically important for that early spring brood rearing. Now, as you may recall, you know, pollen by itself is, you know, obviously it's a food source. It is the protein component of that balance between protein and carbs that the bees need. But for long-term storage, they add some enzymes to it, pack it away, and it becomes bee bread, long-term storage. It's sort of like salad versus like sauerkraut or something like that, right? It's a long-term storage kind of thing. So they will hold on to pollen until the spring comes around or late winter rolls around as it starts to get warmer. So you're probably seeing this if you're in the Southern Hemisphere. So my New Zealand and Australian brothers and sisters down there, you are in a very vulnerable time. This is a time now where your bees are going to say, oh, cool, it's starting to warm up. Let me go ahead and grab some of these last little resources that we have because we need to ramp up brood production in a massive way. So that makes them very vulnerable. So whatever the source might be, whether it's some bee bread they have on hand, in my area we get a lot of dandelion. I mean, it can be just a nice day in January. You get two or three nice days in January or February, and dandelions are popping up everywhere. But, you know, it's not the most nutrient, you know, rich, nutrient-dense food source available, but what it does is it gets them an immediate pollen source and helps them to start that ramp up. But there are three reasons off the top of my head here. I'm sure you could probably make up five or six, but there are three primary reasons that I can think of that you need to really, really pay attention here in the spring. Number one, all of your winter bees are going to start dying. So as soon as those bees start to fly and they start to get some of those early spring resources that are out there, they're going to get into that spring bee, you know, lifespan where, okay, they're flying now. They probably got somewhere between, you know, 1 to 2 weeks and they're going to die. So you've got to go get those resources, bring them back to start replacing all of these winter bees. The next element of that is while all of this rich pollen and all these great food sources are out there, you need as many hands out there, well, as many pollen sacks out there bringing back pollen as possible. So you have to ramp up really, really quickly. And the third consideration there is, I know for me at my house, which is what I was just talking to you about with all the tree pollen, whatever they gather in March, April, May, that's going to be about 90% of what they get for the next full year. I can't always count on a fall flow. When a fall flow comes, it's hit or miss. It's variable depending on the weather, depending on just the conditions, if it's been a dry season, if it's been a lot of rain. All of these variables can kick in and make it basically a non-existent fall flow. Now, down in North Carolina, in the rural area where we have bees down there, that tends to be a different story. You have a great spring flow, lots of good pollen sources. You have some summer sources available, different clovers. You've got some late season sunflower, and you've got goldenrod, aster, ragweed, lots of other things that come in the fall. But down there, it's really, as long as you maintain a good, you know, varroa management strategy, maybe some occasional feeding, you know, coming out of the winter. That's that area, like I mentioned earlier. If you're coming out of winter right now, this is probably one of the few times. I'm not a huge, you know, you guys know, I'm not a huge pollen patty person. I don't use them very often at all. I haven't put a pollen patty on a hive in, I think it's been maybe about 7 or 8 years, I guess. And I'm not saying pollen patties are bad. People who use them are bad. It's not that at all. I've just taken a very, I guess, mostly natural kind of approach to beekeeping. I let the bees make the honey. I let the bees keep the honey. If and when there is surplus, I take some. If I need to expand, a lot of times it will expand from existing colonies so that I'm feeding bees the stuff that they already want to have that's the best for them versus the sugar syrup. And I know that everybody tells you about, oh, no, this is formulated by these experts and this is the exact same thing as what they're getting in nature and it's perfect. Maybe it is. I just have not had great acceptance with the pollen patties that I've chosen. I've used two different types about a decade ago. The bees just were not that into them. And I just haven't gone back. And like I said, I know that they consume them and I know that it can work. I know if you get the right ones or whatever it is, I just have found that if I'm not taking a bunch of stuff from them, they usually figure it out on their own. Where these supplemental feeds become kind of invaluable, I would say, is particularly coming out of the season, the end of the winter, giving them some kind of a boost, you can't drop sugar. Like, you can't just drop sugar syrup into a beehive in January or February where we are now, or, go over to, the Southern Hemisphere when it's really, really cold. Like right now, you can't be dropping a bunch of sugar syrup into the hive and expect them to make use of that. And it's not just sugar syrup, right? They still need to get all those amino acids and the things that are found in the proteins. So they need to get the full balance. Where people are using these a lot is when they get into expansion mode. So that is a component. I know we've talked about it several times, but I have to keep harping on it because it keeps coming up almost, I would say, at least a couple times a week. Should I feed or should I not feed? Should I feed or should I not feed? And all of these feeding things come down to, I saw so-and-so online and they're putting pollen patties everywhere, so I must need to put pollen patties everywhere. I saw so-and-so online and they told me I need a candy board, so I guess I got to have a candy board. Better get some fondant, better get some pollen patties. There's all these things that people are talking about going into winter. Now, we're going to go into this in the next episode. I have a preparing your hives for winter. We're going to talk about physically preparing the hives. We're going to talk about, some of these things around the supplemental feeds, but bringing it back to just focusing on the spring versus the fall pollens, those spring pollens again are really, really geared towards ramping up brood. Now, what I see is in the summertime where I am, it tends to be more of like your nectar flows, things that aren't really producing a whole lot of pollen, but they're giving some supplemental nectar, which is great. It's exactly what the bees need. They've got good long-term storage honey put aside already from the spring flow. They get some survival food kind of during the summer. If I have a dearth and I'm seeing that their bees aren't very active, they're not bringing anything in. If they are light or they're going through resources faster than I think they should, I supplemental feed sugar syrup. Like I said, I do 2-to-1 year round. That works very well for me. And then you roll into the fall. If you have a good fall flow, awesome. That's great. If you don't, may need to supplemental feed. But what's interesting on the fall is those fall pollens are much richer in lipids, in fats, and it has a different amino acid balance to it. The bees themselves, they're going to need enlarged fat bodies to survive for several, several months and be able to be prepared to raise that brood in the following spring. So they need to pack on a lot of that. They increase their fat reserves and get ready to survive for the winter. And this is why you've probably heard me say before that, of course, you always need protein when you're raising brood, but you don't need heavy amounts of protein in the fall like you did in the spring, because in the spring, my bees have historically started raising brood in February, and they'll raise brood February, March, April, May. They'll be tapering in May, and by June, they're pretty much done. They need a good pollen source that whole time. In the fall, they don't. They're going to replace those spring fall bees, get the winter bees in there. They're going to need more of the sugar and the carbs/fats. They're going to need more of that because, again, going into the long-term storage, if they end up with really heavy protein, this is where it goes back to, if you're getting pollen patties or other things, make sure you're getting them things that are like the fall formula, where it's not going to be as pollen and protein heavy, and it's more geared towards the fat and the sugar. But I get asked quite a bit, hey, it's, we're into September now. In fact, I just answered a question on this. Somebody had put a Spotify question, but it was a question, something around, hey, I've got this kind of configuration. This is how many boxes I have, trying to determine, what they would have. In fact, if you're listening, this is actually a good opportunity to address that. I only get so many characters to respond in Spotify. As you guys know, I can kind of keep going for a while on a subject. But the question had to do with having so many boxes and they were using all deeps instead of bringing in, any medium supers or anything. They were just using all deeps for everything because they wanted to make sure they had deep frames drawn out to be used for other purposes, which makes sense. I wasn't crystal clear on exactly how many of those frames were, one, drawn out, and two, actually had honey and reserves and things in them. But as you get to the time of year where you're thinking, okay, we're rolling up on fall here, it's my first year, I'm going into my first winter, I have no idea how much I'm going to need. The questions that you probably need to be asking, whether it's of me or somebody in your bee club or somebody you find online, the question would need to be framed in the sense of, hey, I live around this area. You can give a USDA zone, like I'm in zone 7A or whatever it is. You can give somebody a USDA zone. You can say I'm in this state and get pretty close. If you know, you can give away the state, or if you're in Canada, I'm in this province around this latitude or whatever. Give somebody something to work with to get a rough idea where they are. You know, the needs for somebody who is in Tampa, Florida is going to be vastly different from somebody who's up in Gloucester or, somewhere, up in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, Manitoba, BC. Got to give some shout outs to my northern pals up there. So, yeah, just try to give as much information as you can and we'll try to help out. But when in doubt, I say feed. And when I say feed, for me, again, it's always 2-to-1 sugar syrup. Now, I kind of get beat up on this one a lot. I'll go ahead and I'll reiterate for those of you who don't know. I am a Michael Palmer fan. Now, Michael Palmer is from, and I always mess this up. If you guys know, like, the Robert Palmer, the singer, like, Simply Irresistible, I think is one of his popular songs from, like, the 80s or whatever. I always want to call him Robert Palmer, and I feel weird about that. But Michael Palmer, up in New England, in Vermont, French Hill Apiaries, and he's really cool. He's put together a lot of great videos over the years. A lot of them are at the, I shouldn't say he's put together a lot of great videos, at the honey shows and the different things that he participates in. He's done some great things about the sustainable apiary and sustainable queen rearing, and it's just really, really cool things. And one comment he had made a long time ago, I watched in an interview, somebody said, okay, now you always do 2-to-1 sugar syrup. Why? And he goes, because if my bees need sugar and they need to be fed, why not just give them as much as they can basically take in? If you can take in 2-to-1, why give them 1-to-1? Now, what everybody's always going to tell you is, well, 1-to-1 is going to stimulate brood rearing and comb drawing. Well, no, actually, the combination of having both the presence of pollen and the presence of sugar coming in, right? When you have nectar coming in and you've got pollen, they're like, hey, wow, I think there might be a flow. We need to raise brood. Those two things being present are going to cause brood to be raised. They don't measure the concentration and go, sorry, guys, it's not quite the right concentration. Where you do get more kind of bang for the buck with the 1-to-1 is they will draw the comb out faster because they've got all this nectar coming in. You still can only store the same amount of actual, you know, air quotes, honey, because it's sugar honey, but you can still only store the same amount in one space. So if you're storing 1-to-1 on a frame, they've basically got to store twice as much in that frame that they would if they were just drawing in 2-to-1. So they're still doing twice as much work, but again, the benefit is getting more of that comb drawn out quicker. It does take a lot of resources to draw comb. It does take a lot of resources to draw comb. And doing the 1-to-1 gives them the resources, allows them to draw a lot of comb up, you know, much quicker. It definitely helps for that. As I've stated many times, I'm terrible at managing drawn comb. It's an area that I struggle with. But again, do what's right for you. But when Michael Palmer gave his logic behind that and just said, if they need to be fed, that's what I do. And that's all I do. And I just thought, well, you know, this guy's been doing this for, I think now it's probably close to like 50 years, 45, 50 years. He's found a formula that works. And I love it. And I know I've told you guys too about the, I have a video on YouTube showing you how to do this, but for making that 2-to-1 sugar syrup concentration, I'm going to go ahead and explain to you for about 60 seconds tops. Now there's two ways to do this. One of them is I just use a 25-pound bag of sugar, but if you're not using a unit of measure, doesn't matter. Take a bucket on the inside, 5-gallon bucket on the inside, go down about 3 inches or so, make a black mark with a Sharpie. You can make the mark on the outside if you can see it through. You can take a blade and do a little scrape, whatever you got to do to make a point that you can mark or just estimate, okay, that's going to be about 20 centimeters down or three or four inches down, whatever you want to do. Fill it to that point with sugar, then fill it with water, then get a big mixing paddle. I have a big mixing paddle for that goes into a drill, like a cordless drill, and I mix that sugar syrup up. And as that water fills the air, everything drops down. Fill the water back up to that line again. Mix it again. And you'll do this 4 or 5 times. Once all of your mixing results in no drop at all in the water level, you are now at a perfect 2-to-1 concentration. That's all I do. I remember years ago getting on the stove, heating everything up, mixing in the sugar until it dissolved. And no. I haven't done that in like 10, 12 years. Just do this technique. You can do a 5-gallon bucket in about 3 or 4 minutes, maybe something like that. And you're golden. Now, what will happen is however you disperse that, like if I use that 5-gallon bucket a lot as a feeder itself. I put a lid on it, flip it upside down, make it nice and level. I've already got holes drilled in it, and it's already set up as a little feeding troughs, and the bees will go to town. You will have some of that sugar is going to like kind of recrystallize, right? It's a very dense, a dense kind of mixture. Every couple of days, it doesn't hurt at all to add a little bit of water, maybe add a little bit more sugar, but mix it all up again, and then you're back in business. But if you need to feed in the fall, feed them sugar syrup in the fall. Avoid the proteins. Like I said, again, once they've ramped up those winter bees, they don't need a lot of protein or pollen. Now, you're probably saying like, Jeff, I don't know, man. I've got 8 frames of honey. Is that enough? When in doubt, give them sugar syrup. Because the thing is, you can always be sitting around in the spring going like, man, that's really cool. My bees had 4 extra frames of honey. Whether it's sugar syrup honey or real honey, that doesn't matter. You have live bees in the spring. It is so much better than opening a hive and just seeing a big pile of dead bees in there. And you're looking through every frame and there's nothing there and they're done. It is so disheartening. It is so sad because as a beekeeper, you do a lot of work. If you're doing your job, that's the tough part. A lot of people don't really see a hobby beekeeping or a hobby beekeeper as really having a job. It's just this fun little thing I do in my garden. It's a job. Like, you got to take it seriously. It's a job because in the combination of just inspecting and maintaining the bees themselves, your integrated pest management strategy around varroa and hive beetle, wax moth, like any other kind of disease that can get in there between sac brood, chalk brood, foul brood, blob brood, like all your varroa associated diseases and illnesses, supplemental feeding, expansion. There's just so much stuff that has to be done and it's constant. And a lot of times you can do like 90, what do I shouldn't say 90, you can do like 19 out of 20 things right. And you drop the ball on one thing and that's all it takes. You know, use varroa as an example. Do every single thing else right and you're 19 out of 19 and you're like, nah, I'm not going to treat for varroa. And then you lose your bees. Where it gets really bad is when you don't treat and they make it through the winter and you're like, told you I didn't need that. And then they're all dead. Like in the U.S., they're all dead by like May or June. They're all just sick and struggling and just having a hard time. And it's no good. So if you don't know, just go ahead and feed them and they'll build up some extra. And you never know, it might be just what they need to get through the winter. Eating healthy can feel like a chore sometimes, right? But I've found something that makes it easy and delicious. Washington Red Raspberries. These aren't just any frozen berries. They're grown by family farmers in Washington State, picked at peak ripeness and frozen within hours to lock in nutrients. We're talking fiber, antioxidants, vitamin C, real nutrition with no added sugar, just fruit as nature intended. I toss them into smoothies, stir them into yogurt, and even top my oatmeal with them. They're so fresh and full of flavor, I actually look forward to eating healthier. And honestly, it feels so good knowing I'm supporting American family farms every time I grab a bag, and you'll know they're grown right here in the U.S. because it says so on the package. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at Costco, Kroger, Meijer, and Winco Foods. Look for them in Kirkland's 3-Berry Blend, Smucker's Raspberry Jam, Peanut Butter and Raspberry Uncrustables, or those True Fruit chocolate-covered raspberries I can't stop snacking on. Want recipes, tips, or to see all the places you can find them? Go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.
Your check, your cooperative.
As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
So at this time of year in the U.S., it's like a lot of goldenrod, aster, ragweed, smartweed, knotweed. So there's a lot of things that are out, but I still just get really just baffled and amazed and impressed at how the bees get exactly what they need when they need it. Now, I think there's different ways you can look at this. I, as a person of faith, I would say that, well, this is the way God intended it. He put everything here as is needed in the spring, and they get what they need, and then in the fall they need something different. That's why he has all these other amazing, diverse sources of food that are available in the fall. If you are a person who believes in the, you know, a couple of rocks slammed into each other and that made everything else, then from that you're going to say, well, the bees who need the resources, the bees who were able to adapt to the resources that were present are the ones who are still alive today. Whatever you want to believe, doesn't matter to me. I don't care. I know where I am, so you follow the path that's right for you. But whatever you want to believe, you still got to admit that it's one of the coolest things that nature is delivering exactly what the bees need at exactly the right time. A couple of things just to kind of reiterate here. It is critically important to remember that not all fall flows are created equal. And like I said before, start early, feed early. It's never going to hurt them to have a little bit of extra. Little to no protein going into the winter. Fall is okay as they're building up some of those. You know, if you've got a lot of brood still being produced, a little bit of protein is okay. Just cut that off before you get towards, before things get too cold. And remember, one of the drivers for that minimizing of the pollen, you know, the bees can't get out and go to the bathroom and have cleansing flights and things as often when it gets cold out. So putting a lot of protein in the gut. And it's funny, I watched something that Randy Oliver had done not long ago. And he was under this impression that, oh, well, wintertime bees don't carry a lot of pollen because they're not, it's all fats and lipids. They don't need pollen. And I think that of this sample of like 30 bees that he had crushed up to test on, found that there was pollen in the guts of all of them, which I thought was kind of fascinating. But you just don't want to have an excessive amount because some indigestible material can sit there in the gut. It can lead to dysentery. So pay attention to that. Randy does some really cool studies and research. You ought to go to scientificbeekeeping.com and check out some of the things that he's done around dysentery and Nosema and all that. A lot of times people will generically see dysentery and be like, oh, or they'll see a lot of waste and be like, oh, well, this is dysentery or this is Nosema or it's this or that. But you ought to check that out. Some really good write-ups and research that he's done in that space. So a quick recap here. Spring pollen is really all about giving a good, diverse, amino acid balanced rich pollen formula to raise new brood. Summertime, it's all about sustainment. Hopefully it's, you know, hopefully you can find some sources of nectar, maybe some occasional supplemental feeding in there. They're probably going to dig into the honey reserves a little bit if they do have a dearth. In the fall, hopefully you get a nice fall flow. We're shifting over to fat building and the right nutrition for winter bees. So that's going to be everything that I have for you today on kind of like the spring versus the fall pollens. I think it makes sense. I think it's kind of useful. Does it matter to you as a day-to-day beekeeper? No, right? Keep feeding the bees as they need to be fed. Keep doing what you're doing. Give them space if they need space. That's another thing. You know, in the fall, you're ramping up brood. They're bringing in resources. They can swarm. I've seen multiple people have posted in the Discord room, have emailed me. I had somebody email the other day and they're like, my mentor said that bees don't swarm in the fall and I just watched mine leave. It can absolutely happen. So definitely pay attention with space. Not as much as you need to in the spring, but you do still need to pay attention. And let me do real quick. I'll tell you what, I'm going to wrap up most of everything. I'll tell you my 9/11 story in a second. But for those of you who may not want to stick around for that, I want to thank you to all the people who support the podcast through Buy Me a Coffee. As I mentioned in the last episode, 100% of all the proceeds that I received this year went to buying packages for 2026. So thank you again for that. And we'll go ahead and I'll do my quick story here. So 9/11, September 11th, 2001, I was working in an Intel organization in the DC area. And it was a typical, really typical day. In fact, I remember it was a beautiful day, but I was in some training in Roslyn, Virginia. So for those of you who really aren't familiar with everything geographically, there is sort of like the Jefferson Memorial is kind of like in that river basin area near the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. Just across that river, a little town called Roslyn over there in Arlington. I was in Roslyn for some training. Went to the training on Monday. Everything's fine. Perfectly normal day. Went home. Now, when I was doing this, my oldest daughter was like a year and a half old, something like that. And my wife dropped me off. Now, they had this thing, it's HOV, high occupancy vehicles. So if you have three or more people in your vehicle, you can ride in these special lanes. They now call them the class warfare lanes, because as long as you're willing to spend like $20, $30, whatever it is, you can ride in those lanes during high traffic times. So the government collects more money in taxes from the wealthier people. It's kind of a fun little thing. Anyway, so we had three people. My daughter made number three. So my wife drove the two of us up and dropped me off at the metro station, which the metro in D.C. is like the D.C.'s equivalent of the subway. So I get on in Springfield, I get on the blue line, and I take the metro. You know, it goes through a couple of stops. One of the stops is the Pentagon. It goes, you know, right under the Pentagon. There's actually a stop at the Pentagon. So you can, if you work at the Pentagon, you can get off the metro and take the escalator up and go right to work in the Pentagon. I went like two more stops, you know, past Arlington National Cemetery and then to Roslyn. And I got out and made the walk from the station to the building I was in. I was in a 20-story building and I was on the 10th floor. And I walked in and was chatting with the guys and just regular day. I sat down at this computer and it was a classroom setting for training. There's probably 20 of us total. At that point in time, maybe 8 or 10 of us were in the room. And it's a few minutes before 9 and somebody comes in and they said, "Hey, listen, we're going to be a little bit delayed on our start today. There's been some kind of incident in New York." And I didn't think much of it. I just thought, okay, you know, whatever. And then someone said, "Yeah, you know, a plane hit one of the towers in the Trade Center." And I was like, "Oh, wow, that's interesting." So my mind immediately, somebody's flying like a little Cessna, a little 2 or 4 seater kind of thing, and they just lost control and hit the building. And pretty quickly realized like that wasn't the case. And I thought, well, that's really unusual. You know, I'm not a pilot. I don't know much about piloting anything, but I feel like missing a really big building should be a lot easier than hitting it, I would expect. But I guess, you know, there are certain scenarios. Obviously, you lose control. It is what it is. And then I hear second tower has been hit. And that's when I knew. I'm like, okay, whatever's going on, it's definitely intentional. Now, at this point, I'm probably like a year and a half out of the Army. So my mindset right away goes into like tactical kind of mode. And I'm thinking like, all right, I got to make a plan. And right away, they start closing things. So the metro was closed. So I was about, 22, maybe 22, 24 miles from my home. And of course, it's all, you know, pretty dense city, you know, slightly urban / suburban, depending on exactly where you are in that journey from where I was to my house. So I'm in this building and I had just pretty much standardized on wearing like a 3/4 cut hiking boot, like all the time. I just felt like whatever happens anywhere, if I had this little hiking boot on, I can at least walk or run or move over pretty much any kind of terrain. So I'm wearing this little hiking boot and I'm thinking like, wow, I'm glad I have these on. And I didn't really know what was next. You know, my mind went to some kind of a foreign invasion. Like there's going to be some type of attacks kind of like on the streets, you know, random thing. I didn't know what to expect, but I thought that pretty much anything was on the table. I figured this was the beginning of something. So I picked up the phone. In fact, there was actually, I feel like there was even a phone book. I feel like I remember having a phone book in my hand to actually look up. Oh, for those of you who don't know what a phone book is. Anyway, so I'm looking around and I find a local gun shop because I'm like, I need a rifle. You know, it's just where my gut goes. You know, a little kid likes a blanket. I like a rifle. So I called local gun shop. It was probably, you know, a few miles away. And I said, hey, I just wanted to check and see if you guys are open. I need to drop by. And they're like, oh, no, we're closed. National emergency. And I was like, all right. And that was the closest one. I mean, in that part of, you know, being close to D.C. like that, up in that area, that they're not really big fans. So I didn't have anything else close that I could go to address that issue. My next thought was, I need a bike. I'll buy a bike and at least I can move a lot faster on a bike. Call the bike shop. There was a bike shop, I think like 2 miles away. And there was no way I was taking a cab. Like, I mean, the roads were starting to back up very, very quickly. But I thought, well, I can walk there. So I called him like, hey, I need to buy a bike. And the guy's like, nah, man, we're closing up the shop. We're getting out of here. And I'm like, can you stay for like 20 minutes? I don't care. Like, whatever you got, I'll just take whatever you have. I just need to get a bike. And the guy's like, we got to go. So they're out. So now I'm like, okay, I'm walking. So I thought, well, they had some things there at this place. I was getting the training. They had like some fresh fruit. I remember Jolly Ranchers. Like they had this big bowl of like watermelon, grape, cherry, I don't know, a few other flavors of Jolly Ranchers in this little centerpiece. But they had like bananas and oranges and apples, granola bars, like your oats and honey. And so I just thought, well, I'll grab a lot of this stuff. This would be cool. I can take some of this with me. Water was a big concern because I didn't really have, you know, back then they had bottled water, but it wasn't like it is today. Like now everybody like has, you know, get their phone in one hand and the bottle of water in the other. People always have water all the time. Back then, like we would just actually leave our house without water for 4, 5, 6 hours at a time. I know it's kind of a weird thing, but I remembered seeing a CVS at the building across the street when I first got there that day. So I thought, I'm going to go across the street to the CVS. I'll find like a little backpack or something in there. I'll grab some supplies, maybe a little first aid kit, some water. And there's a thing, I'm not sure if many of you are familiar with it, but it's called Moleskin, M-O-L-E, skin. And it's really good. If you get like a blister on your foot, you can kind of wrap some Moleskin around that area and protect it and kind of keep going. This is something we use a lot in the Army. So if we had to be on our feet for days at a time and your feet are starting to get a little bit funky and then you get a blister, once your feet start to blister, man, if you can't walk, you can't fight. And so I always had Moleskin. I had this this little pack that was on the back of my harness called a butt pack. And it was just a pack that was, you know, literally like above my butt, lower back area. And I always had some Moleskin in the butt pack. And you just cut it to size and put it around the blistered area. And it provides some protection. So I thought, well, with a 20 plus mile walk ahead of me, I'm going to need that. Maybe a flashlight, some other things. So I go down to the CVS and I walk up to the door and big sign on the door, closed, national emergency. And I'm like, geez, this is not getting any better for me. So I go back upstairs and I'm on the 10th floor. I'm sitting back at this desktop computer again, trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And yeah, everybody's still there. Everybody who was in this particular training, they're still there. Nobody had left. And then I hear, hey, the Pentagon's been hit. And I'm like, oh boy. So I go back into that little kitchen area and I find a couple of plastic bags, like, you know, like grocery store plastic bags. And I start loading things up. And I had some kind of a container. I know I had one container that I put water in. I seem to remember having like 18, 20 ounces of water or something, but I definitely had like two bananas, apple, orange, a handful of Jolly Ranchers. I had all that double bagged in these little plastic bags. I'm like, this would be good enough. So I get all that stuff. I've got it back at my desk. I'm just trying to formulate my strategy. I walk out into the hall and I'm thinking like, I wonder if I can see out the other side of the building to actually see the Pentagon. And the way that this building was set up is you had a elevator shaft on both sides of the center of the building, coming all the way up the building. And then as you stepped out of the elevator to the left, you have one office area, and then to the right, you have another office area. And then you had, of course, halls on both sides that, you know, had bathrooms and maybe a couple of other closets, offices, whatever else. So directly across from the office area I was in, this guy, I'm kind of glancing through to see if I can see anything. This guy walks by, sees me, stops, comes back, opens the door and says, "Hey, you want to take a look? You want to see the Pentagon?" And I was like, "Yeah, if you can, that'd be great." So this guy's got like a corner office that's literally facing the Pentagon. So we walk down the, you know, through the whole office area. We get back into that corner and I'm guessing it's about 3 miles. I don't think I've ever actually measured it, but yeah, like about 3 miles away, I'm just watching the smoke come up from the Pentagon. And I'm thinking like, all right, well, here we go. I think I spent about, I don't know, maybe 60 seconds or so there. And I was like, wow, well, hey, man, thanks for showing me. I appreciate it. And I left. I left my stuff in that classroom. I got back in the elevator, went downstairs. And I was just antsy. Like, I didn't know what to do because part of me was like, you got to move. You just got to keep moving. And I just felt that sitting still in an urban area that close to D.C., it wasn't going to be good. But I wasn't quite ready to commit to leaving like the cover that I had in the building. So I'm downstairs again. I go for a little bit of a walk just to see if I can get a view of it from ground level. And I'm on this little bit of a bridge, like a slight little overpass. And this guy has a glass van. So he had those big panel things on the side that support, you know, glass when they're replacing glass panels. And he's got the back of the van completely opened up, or the side doors of it. And there's like three or four of us just standing there listening. And I remember Katie Kerg was on the radio and she's talking about everything that she's seeing and what's going on in New York. And I'm like looking into the van, hearing that. And then I would like look over my shoulder and I watch the Pentagon burning. Then I go back and listen to her and then look back over my shoulder. I did this for probably about 3 or 4 minutes. And then I thought, you know what? I got to get out of here. So I go back to the building. I go back up the elevator and I get back into that classroom. And somebody had commented something like, "Hey, there's a fourth plane. There's another plane that nobody knows what's going on with it. They think it's heading towards DC. We've been told they might be heading towards, you know, going for tall buildings in Roslyn." Now, if you're not really familiar with kind of like, again, not really familiar with the DC area, no buildings in the city of DC are allowed to be taller than the Capitol. But if you go just across the river into Virginia, in Roslyn, there are a few kind of what they would call, you know, I guess in New York, they would call them like, you know, baby buildings or whatever. But in, you know, for us, it would be a skyscraper. But again, 20, 30 floors or whatever, it is a tall building. I think I was in the tallest or one of the tallest buildings in Roslyn. And they had commented that they suspected that they were targeting tall buildings in the area. I remember somebody saying something about the USA Today building. That means nothing to me because I never really did the research to figure out what building that was. I just didn't want anybody to get the wrong one and it end up being my building. So I thought, I got to get out of here. So I'm talking with the guys in the class. I mean, I've got my bag. I'm ready. And I'm talking to this one guy and he says, "Well, I live over on, so there was a mall called Landmark Mall. I don't remember anything else about it other than it's right off of 395, which is basically the route that I needed to take south to get home." He says, "Look, I'll give you a ride to my house. You can take my bike the rest of the way and just get it back to me when you can." And I said, "Are you sure?" He's like, "Absolutely, man. Absolutely." And I was like, "That'd be awesome." So this other guy says, "Hey, would it be cool if I ride with you? I just want to get out of the city. I don't care which way I go. I just want to get out." The guy's like, "Yeah, man, let's go." So I got my bag. The other guy grabs his stuff and the three of us leave. We go down the parking garage, you know, pay for the parking, leave the building, and we're driving. And I'm thinking like, man, this is great. We're moving. I expected complete gridlock. That lasted for about 30 seconds. And then we hit the gridlock. and we didn't move. So we got the radio on and we're listening to everything, and they're just giving reports on different things, what people are seeing, what people are hearing. And after about 15 minutes, maybe, I don't even think it was that long, but 10 to 15 minutes of us sitting in the car, just kind of not moving at all, not making any progress, they come on the radio and they say, "Hey, everybody, just want to let you know that the blue line of the metro is now open." Well, the guy in the car with me and me, we both took the blue line in. So I can't remember the name of the guy who was driving this car, but I said, "Hey, man, thank you so much for offering the ride. I'm going to go get back to the blue line and try to get home." He's like, "Yep, I get it, man. Be safe." So me and the guy, we take off. So we go down to the blue line, or to the metro station in Roslyn. And I mean, it was packed. There were so many people trying to get out. But the first train that came up, we just, you know, we sardined our way in, got into the train and just started making our way. Pentagon Station was closed, so we just went right past that. Made it to Springfield. Now, to me, this was amazing because my trip was probably a 24-mile trip. We had just cut that in half. So I can walk 12 miles all day long. Well, at least when I was, you know, whatever age I was, 27 or so years old, 26, 27, whatever I was back then, I could walk, you know, 12 miles all day long, any day, it doesn't matter. So there's this thing that they do in the Washington, D.C. area. It's been going on for probably 30 years or so now. It's called slugging. And you heard me mention earlier about the HOV, the high occupancy vehicle thing. Well, what these slugs were people wanted to go to work at the same place. Like if you worked at the Pentagon and you wanted to drive your car, well, if you take the HOV lanes, you're going to get there a lot faster. So these areas kind of started popping up many years ago with people that were like, "Hey, I work at the Pentagon too. Let's ride together." So what started happening is people would pull up and they would get out of the car and they'd be like, "Hey, I need two for the Pentagon." And two people who were going to the Pentagon would be like, "Hey, I'm going there." Jump in the car. Boom. You all take the HOV together. It's a win-win for everybody. Two people got a free ride to work and one person got to drive their car and use the HOV lanes. So slugging was a very common thing to do both in and out of the city. So I get to the Springfield Metro and I knew of no slugging that took place there. I had never been there around a time looking for slugs. If I ever went to the Metro, I drove, I parked, I rode the Metro, I got in my car, I went home, you know, when I got back. So I was expecting nothing. My plan was to get there, start walking home. I mean, most of it was a lot of woods on the way there. Once I made it about 3/4 of the way, I knew it would be all area that I roamed as a kid. So like I was not worried at all. I leave the Metro, the actual train. I start walking down this, the walkway, the overpass above the road, the pedestrian walkway. Go across the pedestrian walkway. I'm coming down the escalator. And there's a guy at the bottom of the escalator. And he's holding up a sign. I lived in Woodbridge. And he's holding up a sign that says Woodbridge. And he says, "I need two for Woodbridge." And I raised my hand and I said, "I'm going to Woodbridge." And this guy, like right behind me, says, "I need to go to Woodbridge." He's like, "Great, let's go." So again, had no idea who this guy was, did not care at all. Me and the other guy walk over, we get in his car, we drive away, we get in the HOV lanes, and we're cruising. Like the regular lanes were lots of traffic, like they always are, but the HOV lanes were cruising. And there was this big parking lot. Again, if you're familiar with the area, I want to say it's around exit 156, I think, if I remember correctly. My exit was exit 160, which was Occoquan Lake Ridge. But 4 miles down the road, exit 156 was the, I think it was the exit for the Prince William Parkway, maybe. But there was a big commuter lot down there. And when I was a kid, I grew up and roamed the woods all through that whole area. We were always in the woods back there. So this guy says, "Well, where do you need to go?" I said, "The commuter lot's fine." He's like, "Okay, cool." And the other guy's like, "Yeah, my car is the commuter lot, no problem." So we pull in, he drops the one guy off his car. He goes, "Well, where are you parked?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm not parked. I'm going through the woods." And he goes, "Well, I mean, do you want me to take you home?" And I was like, "Look, man, I don't want to inconvenience you. I'm sure you got a family you got to get back to or whatever. Like, I grew up here. I know these woods. I'll be home within an hour." And he's like, I don't mind giving you a ride. I said, if you don't mind, that's awesome. So he takes me, you know, on another 12, 15 minute drive, gets me into my neighborhood. And I'm like, man, this is far enough, dude. Just drop me here and I'll walk the rest of the way. And the one regret I had is this guy was, he was some kind of an artist or a painter or something. And there was something in his car that was really cool that he had made. And he was like, yeah, I'm selling that. And I had enough money to buy it. And for whatever reason, I didn't. I should have just been like, hey, man, I want to buy that from you. I appreciate the ride. And I didn't. I offered him money. He wouldn't take it, just, you know, just for the ride itself. But I really wish I had bought that thing from him. So I get out of his car and I walked probably a mile and a half from there, maybe a mile to my house, through the neighborhood. And that was it. I made it home to the wife and my daughter and, you know, just hugged everybody, made a few phone calls, tried to check in with people, and then just kind of spent the rest of the day enjoying the beautiful blue sky. But it was crazy. And the weird thing is, so my godfather used to work in one of the Twin Towers. So I'm calling my godmother up in New Jersey and I'm like, hey, is everything okay? And of course everything is busy. I had a heck of a time getting through, but finally that evening I was able to catch up with them and found out that he was no longer working there. But of course, I mean, that was very devastating for everybody in New Jersey, New York, because everybody had friends and family who worked in the city. And it was pretty crazy, but I was really, really happy to get a hold of my godparents and to talk to them. Now, the interesting thing is the Pentagon, my mom worked at the Pentagon. So if you're not familiar with what a PEO is, it's a program executive office. So my mom worked at the program executive office for night vision. And she was in night vision since the 80s. And it was kind of cool when I was a kid. I remember a few times them allowing her to like bring a pair home for the night or whatever. And I remember being like, I don't know what I was, like 9 or 10 years old, and actually having night vision and looking around the neighborhood. We didn't take them out and about, but I was able to step into the front yard and kind of like look around. It was really cool. It was like Gen 1 night vision. It was really poor by today's standards. But anyway, mom, you know, worked at the Pentagon. And what had happened was, I don't remember the exact year, but we'll say that it's maybe, let's say 1998, maybe 99. Geez, it might have even been as late as 2000. It was probably around 2000 when they said, hey, we're going to start renovating the Pentagon. The first group to do renovations was my mom's group. So they moved everybody from her whole area out and they moved her to an office over in Alexandria, over in Crystal City, which is just, you know, a little place right next to the Reagan National Airport, right next to the Pentagon. They moved her to an office building over there. And once her area had been completely renovated, instead of bringing her back, they just took the people that were next door to that area and had them just move over. So basically, the first people to get renovations had to move out, and they weren't going to basically ever come back until all the renovations were done, and then they would be the last ones back. It kind of made sense, instead of trying to move offices all over the place, back and forth, over and over again. Turned out to be a life-saving thing, because the area that the plane hit was right where my mom used to work. So if my mom had not been moved out of there for the renovations, she would not, she's not with us today, but she would not have been with us from 2001 up to 2016. So that would have been a little bit more tragic there. So that's pretty much my 9/11 story. I figured nobody asked for it, completely unsolicited, but I figured it's a good day to reflect, especially again on the heels of an assassination yesterday and lots of crazy things going on in our world. So please take advantage of the time you have today. If you can carve out a few minutes and just, you know, remember the, I think it was 343 firefighters, fire and EMS first responders who were killed that day, over 3,000 people. It was a crazy day that changed a lot of things for us for at least for a few years. Things are pretty much back to the regular level of hatred that they used to be. But, you know, that's my story. So again, thank you everybody who is supporting the podcast through the Buy Me a Coffee and check us out, bestbeekeepinggear.com. We got a few things over there for some reviews, some tips, and some how-tos. And the new website is still about 95% done. I have not fully set up everything the way that I want to, but the downloads section is now under resources. So you can still find all the swarm trap plans, nuked plans, different articles. I've posted a couple of newer articles there about, one of them is about mentoring. One of them is some disease related things. So check those out if you have a few minutes. And outside of that, take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply, in-app only.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is an interior paint and primer in one with a tough-lasting formula. It provides great scrub resistance and durability with remarkable hide and a smooth finish. Save big on Dutch Boy's DuraFighter paint at Menards and start your next project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.